Sierra Morality Court, defending your right to speak and to listen.
This is the Free Speech Union Podcast.
I'm Daphne Whitmore. I'm a member of the Free Speech Union. And today I'm interviewing Tim Wilson. He's the Executive Director of the Maxim Institute. He's a man of many talents. He's an award-winning journalist, a successful author, a former English teacher, and has had several other roles as well. So I'm very happy to be speaking with Tim today. Tim has written an article entitled No Womb, No View, which we will discuss today. But first of all, welcome, Tim. Nice to have you on the Free Speech Union podcast.
Kia ora, Daphne. Nice to be with you. I'm looking forward to disagreeing agreeably with you.
Lovely. actually, first off, could you just tell us a bit about the Maxim Institute? Because I know very little about it, but I know it's been around for a wee while. So, yeah, what are its aims and...
Yeah, look, Maxim Institute is a public policy research and analysis centre. Basically, it's a think tank. There are very few think tanks in New Zealand. There's a total of nine. I think in some respects, New Zealanders have, you know, we pride ourselves on our eminent practicality and our pragmatism. And we don't really like, you know, I think lots of us have heard the phrase, don't overthink it. Well, that's actually our job at Maxim Institute, to think about things. And we have the time to do it, which is a real gift. We're a charity, so we're supported by donations. And we're committed to a more just, free, compassionate, and hopeful Aotearoa New Zealand. And mostly our job is to help leaders make wise decisions. That's what we do with our research, our public engagement, etc.
And like, do you sit somewhere on the political spectrum, or do you not see yourselves in that?
No,
it's a difficult thing anyway now to figure out what is the political spectrum today.
We're non-partisan. We have a worldview I would say I think it's a view that. Says that everyone's got dignity, an innate dignity, and we have to affirm that, even if we don't agree with them, which is somewhat inconvenient when you want to. I mean, the trends in culture these days are to say, okay, you disagree with me, therefore you must be stupid, you must be one of the sheeple, you've had too much social media, blah, 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 you know, that desire to negate and diminish those who disagree with you. Actually, we like people to disagree with us, and when we do our research, one of our first phases is the listening phase. If only people did more of that listening in public life, like we're doing now, perhaps we might have a few more informed discussions.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the way you find out the gaps in your own argument, isn't it, too? Mm. And it's how you change your mind often, I think. So just looking at the article that you wrote, it attracted quite a bit of attention. You published it on the Maxim Institute, and it got published elsewhere too, didn't it?
Yeah, it got picked up by the a couple of Gisborne Herald, Northland Age, etc. I also put it on my Facebook page, and I used to live in the United States, so some of my American friends responded to it. This is obviously after and during the whole Roe versus Wade. What is it? Outpouring. Let's say it's an outpouring.
Okay, so the piece was entitled No Womb, No View. Mm. And in it you've noted that there's a sort of prevailing view that, look, if you're not at risk of having a baby, you should shut up. And you say the rationale has some merit. Men don't have children, women do. And that, you know, proximity to a situation might compel us to consider it more deeply. And that really you acknowledge people should be allowed agency over their own bodies. But you do also say, look, it's not just women who have something to say on abortion. As an unplanned child yourself, you were adopted out. And so you say you have a personal interest in the topic. And so, you know, you raise a few questions, which I thought would be good to flesh out here in this discussion. Well, let's just start off and say, like, why should it not be restricted to women, the debate around abortion, in your view?
Well, I guess I responded when I saw that placard being held up at a protest in Auckland. No uterus, no opinion. Something visceral occurred within me because as an unwanted, unplanned, inconvenient child, and I've been aware of how much the circumstances of my my early life, my conception, have affected the person that I am today. As one of those people who I must confess, Daphne, I don't have a womb. I'm not a man with a uterus.
Look at that.
But I do have a strong view about abortion. I believe it's a moral catastrophe. And so the idea that I'm being told that I can't have a view because I don't have a particular, biology, seems to me incorrect. I think that abortion there's a whole lot of woozy assumptions that are based around that view. Only those directly affected can comment on a particular issue. But isn't there a sense of us all having to, if something's important, we need to be able to comment on it? All of us do. The fact that we're having this conversation is part of that ongoing discussion about issues that really, really do affect the essence of what kind of society do we want to have? How do we protect the most vulnerable? Who are the most vulnerable? When we're talking, it's interesting when you're talking about agency over one's own body. Well, whose body are we talking about? Are we talking about the child who's growing inside the mother or the mother? These are all things that are really important. And the idea that a particular identity then disqualifies your ability to discuss and debate them is wrong-headed. I think it's frankly wrong-headed because they're such big matters. They're important. And also, so what identity do you have? So, for example, for this, as we've gone into this discussion, I've gone from being a executive director at a think tank to an ex taxi driver to a ex teacher, et cetera, and now I'm talking as an adopted child, an inconvenient child. So we all contain. I mean, the poet Walt Whitman said, "I contain multitudes." We all contain many identities, and we all balance them within who we are. But the notion that externally you're prevented from having a discussion because of one identity that I choose, that I assign to you, that seems to me it's not just incorrect. It's also like I'm deciding who you are. So I'm deciding that you should shut up. Well, guess what? I'm not going to shut up because I think it's important. Now I'll shut up.
I don't disagree with you about, that particular issue, that of course a range of people are going to have views. And there's some people who are going to have no view on abortion. Some people, it just won't interest them. But I guess a doctor who's conducting abortions or being asked to conduct abortions who may be male, for instance, would expect them to also have a view on what they're doing. And yeah, obviously men are involved in families and so on. So
Yeah, there are three parties. There are three parties involved in an unwanted pregnancy. There's the child, there's the mother, and there's the father. And all of those people, I think clearly it's the. I mean, and as I say in the piece, my birth mother is the hero of my existence, I am just so. So in awe of what she did for me. She was compelled to do it by the state in some way, but what she did for me when she was 15, I think of myself at 15, to actually give birth and then to give a baby up for adoption, must have had, and look, I'm in touch with my birth mother. And she said it had a huge effect on her. She made a huge sacrifice on my behalf, even before she knew me. And that's what a gift. I mean, I'm absolutely I'm in awe of her. Let's put it that way.
I guess, I mean, debate is one thing, but decision-making is another thing, isn't it? And I think perhaps most of the heat around the discussion is more that who does get to decide. Like, it's fine for anyone to have an opinion, but, you know, when it comes down to the decision-making, clearly a woman has a much bigger part in this pregnancy. Like, you know, it's just the way evolution dish things out, and that the males of the species make a very brief contribution, which is of no great sacrifice, quite the opposite, and the woman takes on a huge health risk, a huge undertaking, a huge emotional experience, and then, you know, for many years afterwards. So, but it's all done in the context of a society, isn't it, too? It's not that we're wandering around as completely individual units.
Can I also say that there's someone we haven't mentioned here, and that's the child. So it's like, who gets to decide? I want to say I have never been a clump of cells. I have always been a human being. And when we have this discussion, we often frame it in terms of the adults, those involved, those who are already fully alive and self-sufficient. We often don't talk about it from the point of view of the child growing inside the woman, and that's because abortion in some ways is a debate about when life starts. I believe life starts at conception. And so I think it's important to include in that discussion, what would this person want? I have loved being alive from the moment I became conscious of who I am, through ups and downs. I understand, I guess, in some sense, because of my conception, that life is a gift. But so I guess I'm saying, let's correct that. Let's correct the framing in some ways and say, at least create the thought experiment. What would the child want, as well as what does the mother want?
Knowable? I mean, that's not knowable, is it? And in utero, the child wants nothing particularly consciously, does it? It's pretty automated, isn't it? It's about wanting
a good blood supply,
good oxygenation, you know, a relatively calm environment, presumably, with, you know, great nutrition.
In summary, they want to live.
That is the way they behave, generally, yes. But that's nature taking its part. And we do a lot of things to manage nature, don't we, to make life more bearable, more enjoyable, more meaningful. And so we don't just allow nature to follow its path, do we? We intervene.
I think we do.
All sorts of things.
I wouldn't add the natural desire for life that exists with each of us to be put in the same category as building houses, putting up an umbrella, beating nature.
Building houses is very fundamental to our survival, isn't it? It comes pretty close to survival perish.
Yeah. But when you're saying we manage nature, I was putting it in that context. So, I mean, yeah, it is, but we could probably manage nature less and live in tents, you know, if we thought that way. But the reason I raised that is that I wanted to separate the management of nature with the individual human desire for life, which I think is inherent in everyone. I guess this is where the rubber meets the road, Daphna, is where we're trying to assess. So is a child growing in utero just another part of nature to be managed, or is that a human, a vulnerable human, whose life needs protection? That's the question I would ask.
Yes, the issue does often turn on the question of agency, which you raised, you know, and so often there's something of a contest of rights, isn't there, in society? So the right of women primarily as the main people involved in reproduction or carrying the bigger load of that.
Absolutely.
And that's just the way evolution divvied it out. It just had to. You couldn't go 50-50 and survive. You know, it was a good strategy, but so it comes down to, you know, who has agency, not necessarily in an absolute sense, because people don't live in an absolute way, do they? We navigate and negotiate all sorts of things in our lives. If we say that the fetus has more agency than the woman, do we not diminish the rights of the woman to say, look, you know, and really, this is a new problem for humans that, okay, abortion has existed for a very long time, but the right to control our fertility is pretty modern, isn't it? It's sort of, let's say, I would put it, say 1960, the invention of the pill was the first time we had the ability to control fertility in a way that enabled women to participate in society in a different way, and freed men also to pursue things that weren't available when you just had large families barely existing.
Can I get back to something that you raised where you were saying, sure, does the child have more agency more rights than the mother? I'm not arguing.
I just say fetus.
A fetus.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you said,
of course, we use different terms because the perspective is different. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's agree that you can say fetus.
I mean, I would say humans are born as fetus. I mean, like compared to other mammals, when we're born, I mean, a similar mammal would give birth to something that'd be like a 2-year-old child. I mean, we basically give birth to a very, very dependent being, don't we? More than any other mammal that I can think of.
Look, I'm content for you to use the word fetus, even though I would object to it, because I believe that the child grows inside the womb. All I was arguing for is that we as we consider this, we think about the life of the child growing in utero, rather than often the discussion is about, well, what's the woman's situation? Is she in a position to have this child? My birth mother was in absolutely no position to have me, but she was compelled to do so, and she did bravely. And what's happened is, since we've been able to connect, and I've known her for 20 years, she's experienced a kind of healing, getting to know me and understanding what she went through. It's given a better perspective on what she went through. So there is a benefit to bringing the children into the world. And if we assess it purely on the circumstances of the adults, I think we're missing a big part of the picture.
Okay. So, I mean, I understand that perspective, and I think there's a certain humanity to it too that is sometimes missing from the pro-choice side, although I think the pro-choice side also has a lot of humanity in it, and it's sort of recognition of what women experience with pregnancy and so on. So, I mean, I'm saying you're a Christian, is that correct? Does that sort of influence your outlook on this subject?
No, it hasn't.
It's not
because
related to that.
No. Well, I mean, it's given me a philosophic and theological understanding of it. But I was a pro-life agnostic before I was a middle-aged Catholic convert. So I had to consider increasingly as I got older this. So I was pro-choice in my 20s.
Right.
I remember as the US correspondent for TVNZ, I was interviewing a bunch of pistol-toting Republicans from Texas at one of the Republican conventions, and these guys were your your cartoon American God, Guns and Gays Republicans. You know, they had, I think they had stars and stripes cowboy hats. I don't know if I'm making that detail up or not. But we were I was talking with them, interviewing them about a bunch of issues. And I said, what do you think about abortion? Because, you know, I'm pushing all the buttons and this is during my pro-choice period. And I said, what do you think about abortion? One of them just looked at me and paused and said, I think, I am absolutely pro-life. I don't think abortion is permissible under any circumstances. I said, well, what about a woman's right to choose? And he just looked at me and he paused and he said, you'll grow up one day. And it was, I've always remembered that. And I thought it was sort of, at the time, I reared up, but it's a remark that stayed with me. And as I came to consider the circumstances of how I came to be on the earth, it planted a seed and I can't repudiate those circumstances. So when we talk about, how this issue was shaped, and has been shaped with me, I've gone through a bit of a journey. And I think we love the black and white of say, well, this is the view. No uterus, no opinion. It's very straightforward. It's very easy. But, and I had that view in my 20s when, to be frank, I hadn't thought about it deeply. I've thought about it more and I've come to this view and I came to it before I ended up, that very suspicious character, the middle-aged Catholic convert. That's how I came to it. Sorry, long answer. Sorry, yeah, Daphne, no, long interesting. Answer. I'm gonna shut up.
No, perfectly all right. And so, look, if you were in charge of formulating legislation for New Zealand, would you change the abortion laws as they exist now?
Yes, of course I would. Mm-hmm. Have I looked at? I would say yes, of course I would. My understanding of them is that they were liberalised in the last abortion law change. Now, do I have a catalogue of things that I would do? No, I don't. I haven't looked at them deeply enough to be able to make sensible and reasonable assessments on them. But yes, I would. Now, the question then would be, well, is that something that Maxim would do a piece on, or it's not something that we'll weigh in on this discussion when we talk about it from a philosophic and moral point of view, in terms of the doing something on the abortion laws at the moment. That seems to have moved on. I think there's an issue. You know, certainly we made a submission on the safe spaces legislation that was passed. Our view was that it wasn't clear that there was a requirement for the suppression of that that right to protest. It was a law written on the basis of ideology rather than actuality. Crown law said there were very, very few examples of it. So why are we pushing this law through? You know, I think
I couldn't think of a case where there had been any demonstrations. Know outside Green Lane Clinical Centre, there used to be a single man standing at an intersection a block away with a placard. But, you know, it's a big centre. You wouldn't know where the abortion clinic is. But maybe they were foreseeing as the law changed and people doing medical abortions and you could do it at a GP practice, that maybe they would become focused for harassment. I think so. The people pushing for that legislation were saying, look, it's debating and protesting is hurtful and harmful to the women having abortions. I think I agree with that, but I also feel that if, you know, when people make decisions in life, we have to deal with those things, don't we? Because that's part of the decision-making process, is actually not blocking everything out, but turning a whole bunch of ideas around in our heads. So the other thing I wondered about with that law was, what if you wanted to protest perhaps the medical care of that clinic? Maybe you thought actually they were doing a substandard thing. So, how do you, maybe that would be not necessarily that a protest outside would be the best way to complain about the standard of care, but it might be one avenue that you might want to use. And now that Is that gone too?
Now it's blocked. Yeah. Yeah, and I think I do think, and this to bring it back to the wider issue I wanted to raise with the column, which is that the notion that there are some places where you can't protest, or there are some areas that you can't have a view on because of who you are. I think it's very dangerous. It's very dangerous to prescribe that because that prevents, as you say, discussion and debate. But it also constricts the ability to. And it's not just we're just gonna target it on these people. It's like there can be unintended consequences when law. There often is unintended consequences when laws are passed, and increasingly laws are passed very swiftly in this country. Even 5-10 years ago, we were known to have the fastest laws in the West. They seem to be speeding up, and fast laws are often bad laws. So let's take our time to discuss these things and make sure we get them right.
I think especially if there isn't a pressing need for it, if there wasn't some sort of major problem on our doorstep, it is a risk. So just thinking a bit about debate, because there's obviously a lot of grey area, and you've got the two poles of the debate, which is the one hand saying abortion is murder, should never happen, and then the other pole is, well, women can choose right up until 40 weeks. And I think both positions are quite abstract, and that they're holding up the sort of black and white principles where, you know, most people's views sit somewhere in between. I mean, what role do you think debate plays when an issue is polarised like this?
Look, I think the more that when you say they're abstract, are they extreme, or is it, I just want, can you unpack it in the sense that are they on the extremes there, so they're not contributive? So you're saying the truth lies somewhere in that in-between grey zone?
I think in reality most people don't sit at those extremes, that most people don't really feel comfortable with abortion at 40 weeks, and most people also don't support the complete banning of abortion. And probably today there's the majority would be supportive of relatively liberal abortion rights, but I don't know quite where. Cut-off pointers. And then we have the whole question of technology has made this question even more complicated.
You mean the ability
as
to look inside,
you know, at what stage a fetus can survive, you know, or what? It's a baby once it's born, in my view.
It's interesting. You raise a couple of things there that I would say, well, even if I. And we've seen this at numerous instances before where a whole, a majority of society supports something that is morally wrong. The majoritarianism doesn't automatically confer moral authority.
No.
So I would push back against that, to use that dreaded phrase, push back. I think what I'm saying is I'm actually disagreeing with you, and that's fine.
I'm not holding up. I'm not saying all the majority are right. I mean, it's just one way of decision making, isn't it?
Isn't it interesting that I use that phrase? I would push back on that. We've got all these. I don't know if it's a New Zealand thing. Do you think as New Zealanders, because we're in a small society, we're inclined to quickly. I don't know if you've been in this predicament, Daphne. I can be quite disagreeable at times, and I found myself at dinner parties making statements that people quickly run to find. When I say dinner parties, around the table, that's far too august. But people quickly. We often rush to find consensus when, in fact, we're actually disagreeing with each other. It's like, no, it's like, oh, well, what about da-da-da? Can we all agree on that? It's like, no, I don't necessarily want to agree. Yeah. I want to know what I disagree with you on so that we can actually understand a bit more about what we think ourselves, where the gaps are in our own arguments by what you're hearing. You know, it was St. Thomas Aquinas, I think, is said to believe that, or it's one of his quotes, is that the truth is an ocean and we all have a bit of water on us. And I want to know what you're thinking to help me think what I'm thinking. Do you think we've got an aversion to disagreement in New Zealand?
Yes. In New Zealand is have long had this thing where, even just talking politics, you'd think there was some sort of Stasi around, that talking politics is just not, you know, with a small p, it's not polite, and they don't really like the clash of ideas. Although politically minded people do enjoy that, but it's not everybody wants it, do they? And find it, some people find it very difficult.
I wonder if that's because we're. I think in a way it's. I'm torn. I don't know the answer to this. I don't know if it's because we're conflict averse, which I think in some way we are, but we're also perhaps a more cohesive society in the sense that if there's only a couple of, you know, we're one or two steps removed from each other, so everyone sort of knows everyone else. So there's that desire to because we're basically a big small town, we all want to get along, and that's laudable. But I think it's not always productive when we want to debate things. I haven't figured it out. Whereas, for example, I lived in the States for a long time, and the actual mode of engagement is flagrant disagreement. I mean, Americans, because they value freedom, they will just disagree with you. They'll shoot from the hip. It's punchy, exciting. I don't know if it's actually healthy. So I'm not sure where I stand. Do you have a view on that?
I think maybe these things just evolve culturally. You know, like, we're not a sectarian riven society in New Zealand, which is fortunate. But perhaps the price you pay for it is sort of duller dinner parties, maybe. So let's talk a bit about, you know, how we deal with polarizing discussions.
I want to just raise something, because I think we've both agreed that there's something quite cohesive about New Zealand society. Fundamentally, I would submit that in the last 2 years we've become far less cohesive. The COVID experience, lockdowns, mandates, the responses, the demonization of people who don't get vaccinated, all of that has produced, what were fissures in our society have extended, and they've become we've become much more fragmented. I would say we're probably more divided now, and there are polls that support this, than we've ever been. And it is concerning. I mean, we can't just say, we're a big small town, we'll just always get along. We're not getting along now. We're seeing, I don't know, what are you seeing, Daphne?
I feel very much the same way, that it feels that we're polarized. And maybe to the cultural wars, the what I call woke, I know a lot of people don't like that word, I just haven't found a substitute for it. Woke people are incredibly intolerant of different views, and so people tend to shut down.
Don't you know, Daphne, intolerance is the new tolerance.
It is indeed. Everything up is down, black is white, and words don't mean things, so
it's a difficult we're changing the definition of what words mean, and George Orwell would have a lot to say about that. His incredible essay Politics in the English Language, I would absolutely encourage anyone who is listening to this to go and read that, and if they've read it, to reread it. I would say also it's importing, in some ways we've imported American culture, and I sort of was noting this in the column as well, American culture war modes into our own society, where I think we've got our own way of dealing with these things. Or do we? I don't think we've figured it out. We've got an instinctual way of dealing with it, which I think we've talked about with the sort of desire to immediately produce consensus. We need disagreeable mode or disagreement is raised. But we need to think more about how we disagree as citizens of Aotearoa New Zealand, rather than just go, we'll get the American ways in, and it's odd. I don't think we'd the way that say, for example, Russia tends to resolve disagreements. I don't think I want that imported to our society. So I think we've got a lot of thinking to do.
Yeah, we do. And I guess it's a maturing process, isn't it, to deciding how are we going to work through these issues. It seems to me the abortion question is settled for the foreseeable future, because we have relatively new laws. It enables women to have abortions earlier rather than later, which more people feel comfortable with, I think. So there's probably going to be less friction and impetus for change there. But really my interest in interviewing you about this was I wanted to understand, you know, how does it feel when, you know, you're on the side of an unfashionable idea or, you know, relatively speaking, perhaps, or maybe it is that more people share your view than we know because that viewpoint isn't getting the same airing. I think it seems to me that Christianity is unfashionable now, and certainly in the media and public spaces, seems to be people feel quite free to ridicule Christianity and Christian views.
Sure.
Is that your experience? And
yeah, look, in terms of your assessment of the the abortion issue, I don't believe that the pro-life cases have been adequately canvassed in discussions of the issue when it is discussed. I think when the Roe v. Wade was rolled back in the States, there was immediately an outcry. There wasn't an attempt to engage with it as an understanding of a constitutional matter for Americans. What they were saying was that this is not really for the Supreme Court to decide on. They kicked it back to lower courts. They, in essence, they politicized the discussion rather than constitutionalized it. But there was no attempt to engage with that in the commentary that we saw here in New Zealand. It was all framed very emotively. And I would say, there have been surveys done where it's like, was the pro-life, is it? I don't think it's a 50-50 split in New Zealand, far from it. But I do think there are more pro-life people than you would be led to believe exist from a sort of cursory canvassing of mainstream media. So I don't think there's an accurate representation there. Having said that, I think in some sense you're right that the issue. There won't be much more talk about this issue for a while. I still believe there are discussions to be had, and my sense is that future generations will condemn us for our position on this view. That may be just an emotional sense. I'm not sure, but I think as we come to understand more about life in utero through technology, we'll come to, I think, have a better understanding of what we're engaging with. In terms of the wider Christian question, it's really interesting. I was talking with a guy in Australia, a bloke called Tim Costello, who's been mayor of St Kilda, also a prominent Christian, etc. He's on the ABC all the time. About this difference between Australian society, where you can say, oh, look, I've got a faith, this is where I'm from, and New Zealand society, where having a faith is seen as somehow objectionable. I can frame it if we go back to America again. So, for example, if in America you say, I believe in Jesus Christ, then there's a good chance that you will be president. If in New Zealand you say, I believe, that the Lord Jesus Christ is my savior, there's probably no chance that you will ever be prime minister of this country. And why is that? I'm not exactly sure, but I think we do believe in New Zealand. Then this goes back to those discussions you're talking about. What was it? Politics, religion, and sex. We don't discuss those in public. Well, actually, unfortunately, we do discuss quite a few of those things. We certainly don't discuss religion, though. It seems to be seen as a private matter.
Yes, which I quite like that in the sense that it's comfortable if you are not of the main religion. I'm an atheist with Jewish family, so I've never felt comfortable with Christianity being imposed in the public space.
But now
things have changed, and Christianity doesn't really get imposed in the public space so much. So it is kind of the opposite. I mean, I guess in the US, if you're an atheist,
how does it feel to be part of the majority, Daphna? Are you enjoying it?
No. Maybe I'm just disagreeable, but in the US, of course, you can't be the president unless you say, God bless America, can you? Unless you believe in Jesus. It's
I mean, you look at Donald Trump holding Bibles upside down and praying awkwardly. This is someone who you would think their private life. I'm not going to judge whether he has a relationship with Christ or not. But what I will say is that superficially it seems that it's a very complicated relationship if it is one, given his public expression of his morality. But having said that, he put Supreme Conservative justices on the Supreme Court, which then created this whole situation, Roe versus Wade being rolled back, which is why you and I are having this korero. So interesting.
I guess maybe we should just perhaps finish with a bit of a discussion around how we're going to navigate, like, having a secular democratic society.
Mm.
How do we have the discussions that enable a voice for people with religious views and non-religious views to feel that they have genuine say? I mean, not just feel it, but actually have a say and be respected.
I think as a Christian, I believe that everyone has the image of God. So therefore, I have to respect every person and see them as one of God's children, and because of that, then I have to be humble in my approach to them, and I have to be respectful in the things that I say and the things that I think. I actually have to discipline my own thinking. It's like I don't. So how do we have these discussions? One of the things we've been thinking about at Maxim is how to disagree agreeably. And so, number one, to see what's common between each other, I think that's really important. Not to see, Daphne, you're pro-abortion. You're not a fully formed moral individual. I hate your conscience. I'm not going to do that. Mm-hmm. You're someone who is, who has a different view to me. Now, I would absolutely disagree with you on so many things, but I still want to affirm that you are someone who is making these decisions in good faith and in good conscience as you understand them. I'm not going to say that you're misled. I'm not going to say none of that stuff. So I think we need to affirm what we have in common. We also need to widen our worlds, in the sense that I follow people on social media that I don't agree with, and I have to discipline myself not to troll them because I want to hear what they're saying. One of the other thing is to have as wider circles as you can. So you actually, I mean, and this is part of it, is actually having people who are like-hearted but not necessarily like-minded, so that you can disagree about something, but still stay mates.
That's such a good phrase, isn't it? I mean, that saves you from being in a cult, really, doesn't it? It keeps you out of a cult-like existence.
Well, it's very unfortunately that, and this is the problem, I think, with the fact that all of our discussions are transacted on the internet now, is that the algorithm just gives you refractions of yourself, and it creates a kind of brittleness that. I've actually really enjoyed our discussion. You've given me things to think about. I've had an experience that will affect how I think now about this. But if we don't have that experience, we listen to people who are just, we just sit in the echo chamber, we're going to lose something. So yeah, like-hearted, rather than like-minded, it's really important.
Mm. Excellent. The sort of new feminism that I mentioned, had you come across it at all? The people, these women that are writing?
Not really, but I think you're right about the sexual revolution. It's not been helpful for women. Can I read you something?
I think it has been helpful in part, but that, well, like all revolutions, I guess, they overdo things in a revolution.
Yeah,
and then you pull back afterwards and go, whoa, we were kidding ourselves about some things.
Now, as part of the discussion about this this column, I got this this note from someone I knew in New York City, and a woman in her mid-30s. She talked about the position on abortion and how it was worth revisiting. But she also said this. On another note, I'm so tired of the whole birth control movement. Even birth control is such an awful phrase. They could have called it birth choice or conscious conception or family planning, which I think they have, for goodness sake. Every time I go to the doctor, their first question is what kind of birth control I'm on. My entire life, not once have they asked me about my fertility or talked about ways to support or safeguard it, or been honest about the repercussions of so much birth control on so many of our bodies, brackets primarily women, the toll of 30 years of hormone-altering pills or inserted medical devices. Again, I'm not against birth control per se, but I'm horrified with what liberal institutions have done with my body. I've been treated like a fertility problem all my life. Isn't that fascinating?
Well, it's an interesting way to frame it. I think everybody has their own experiences in the consultation room, but on the whole, I see the ability to control fertility as a major development for humans that both has given us opportunities we just didn't have before.
True, and I agree with that.
And a lot of those contraceptive methods have health benefits too. You know, I think an awful lot of women died in childbirth before.
But was that because of the state of medical care at the time? I don't think you could completely say that.
I think partly it's a big part of it is just nature doesn't care if half of us die giving birth at some point, as long as, you know, the species is reproduced. Like, it, from an evolutionary perspective, it doesn't matter if women die after giving birth to their fourth child. We actually evolved to have societies that can manage. And we have huge heads and a pelvis that's designed for walking. So, some tension there that, you know, that is how the human body is. And it's also why we have to give birth to such underdeveloped humans, because if we leave it any longer, they won't get out. You know, we give birth to creatures that cannot survive for several years on their own.
Correct, and that's how we bond as well. So there are other benefits.
My
friend says that I can see why a certain generation would have gone that way. But for me, it's time to change and deepen the conversation. Threw out too much baby with the bathwater. Far from not objectifying, the contemporary liberal movement has also completely reduced us to our body parts. You're just a person without a uterus, so you can't comment. Awfully, when I read medical papers now, I'm no longer a woman, but referred to as a person with a uterus or person with a vulva.
That is the extreme end, isn't it? But unfortunately, the extreme end is becoming state policy, and our documents here are being rewritten. Our institutions in New Zealand are talking like that. The organisations that promote cervical screening for women are now talking about body parts like that.
Yeah, and I think I one comment I would make about that is that we're essentialising. You know, we are reducing people to body parts at the same time, and it seems contradictory. We're saying that body parts aren't actually part of the definition of what it means to be a woman or a man. But that's probably a topic for another discussion, Daphne.
Any big topics out there? Thank you, Tom. Yeah. Thanks so much.
No, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Free Speech Union podcast. If you would like to learn more about us or find out how you can get involved or support, you can head on over to fsu.nz or check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Ka kite anō.